Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Hello. Welcome. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. As you just heard me say, you know, I recorded that intro 10 years ago. That's crazy. This show has existed for 10 years. That doesn't seem right. Anyway, this is that show, Speak Up, on CJSF 90.1 FM. I said that, and this is the third time you've heard it. I'm Jesse. Hope you're doing well this morning. The rain has returned. I guess it was here yesterday, too. But after a long, clear break, we're back into traditional lower mainland winter. And I don't hate it. I do like the sun, but I don't hate the rain. Anyway, hope you're doing well. Today on the program, we've got a few different things. We've got an interview with the artistic director of the Push Performing Arts Festival. We've got one of Danny's pieces. He did another Salmon Story, and I believe played on his Tuesday show, but Danny does love Salmon Story, so we're going to play that again. And maybe another piece by Danny about the Failures Wanted Museum, or the Museum of Failure, that was at the point that Danny did the interview, was still just seeking submissions, but now has opened in the Kingsgate Mall, and Danny attended the opening this week, and really quite enjoyed it and heartily recommended it. So we'll see how we're doing time-wise once we get through things. We might also hear from our friends at CICK in Smithers. So we'll get there. Sorry, yes. Anyway, we're going to start with some music because we always do that here, and because I love local music, and because I love this artist. It is the lead single from the Golden Age of Wrestling's upcoming album, Sweet Chin Music, which comes out in about 2 weeks now, February 12th. Not next Friday, but the one after. Very excited. Sorry, I guess Thursday. 2 weeks today. Cool. We're going to hear, you've heard this on this show before, but it's great. So we're going to hear it again. This is Revenge Body, Denton, Texas, by the Golden Age of Wrestling. We'll be right back.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
Since 2003, the PUSH Festival has been running annually in Vancouver as an interdisciplinary, multimodal space for artists across mediums to interact and perform. Today, I'm speaking with Gabriel Martin, the Artistic Director for the festival. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
In what ways do local artists and communities shape PUSH's identity, and how do artists from across Canada and beyond fit into that?
Yes, thanks for the question. I think, you know, each year there are local works in the festival that are so critical to balance the international and the national. And I think those works are always in dialogue with each other. That's our goal. And then literally we try and create space for dialogue around them. I'm not just, there are artist talks, you know, after the shows. There are interviews I conduct with artists that are disseminated digitally around the shows, and workshops. But also we have this industry series for arts industry artists, producers, presenters to come together for a week during the festival, see work together. And really to be in dialogue about what it means to create and present in this contemporary moment. It's a really important platform also for local artists to get their work seen by colleagues, people they know or don't know from across Canada, from abroad. That's a rare opportunity because of our relative geographic isolation. And it's a really important role that PUSH plays. And from the beginning, the festival was envisioned as an international festival, but an international festival that is creating that space for dialogue and exchange by having artists local, national, and abroad sharing stages, sharing spaces. That's something that's special about a festival that's different from a seasonal presentation kind of format where everybody's in the city at the same place, at the same time, same place. And there's something that's possible because of the relationships that, you know, emerge, or at least the potentiality of that. And then your second question was about national artists, was it?
Yeah, from across Canada, then beyond. So worldwide, international.
Yeah, the festival is fundamentally about expanding our sense of the world, our paradigms for expression and relation. So having the intersection of diverse perspectives and practices is really like the foundation of what this festival is about and has been from the very beginning when, you know, it started at a time where there were very few presenters presenting national, international, contemporary performance. So, you know, a lot of the work presented in this festival is interdisciplinary or adventurous in form, is in conversation with social and political urgencies. And we're still limited in terms of the number of presenters and just kind of the scale of our scene locally in terms of the capacity to welcome that kind of work. So, you know, it was especially critical in the moment it was started in terms of being able to bring work that wouldn't otherwise come here. And now there's more opportunities, there are more presenters, but it still remains unique. And I am not, I don't think I'm out of place in saying that it's very critical. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, as artistic director, what are some of the core values that guide your curatorial decisions for the festival?
Mm-hmm. Well, that it's a truly international festival. And I mean, it's in the title and maybe that sounds obvious, but it's actually quite complicated to present a festival that has work that is from the global north as well as the global south because of the economics, because of the kind of neo-colonial economic reality, cultural economics, where there is just so much more support from, you know, in general, from countries that are part of the global north to financially support touring artists and creative export that doesn't happen in a lot of other places in the world. And so that's a real value and priority in terms of being able to create some equity in terms of who we see on stage when we say international, who that it's not just artists from Europe, even though there are obviously lots of great artists from Europe and also lots of diasporic, like artists that belong to diasporic cultures from elsewhere in the world based in Europe. Yeah, so that is one, and you know, we aim to support that value or realize that value by also investing in co-productions where we can, you know, which is a limited resource at this point, but I'm trying to develop that. So for example, tonight we premiere Kamwe Kamwe, which is a work we're co-producing by the Zimbabwean dance company Jerihuni Movement Factory. Yeah, that's just one of the ways that we work towards that. And beyond that, the values, I mean, that I kind of mentioned the simple mandate to expand our sense of the world. And so that is really done by how the work helps us situate ourselves in relationship to the issues, you know, the contemporary global issues. And that also sparks our imagination because that's where change happens. That's where we can imagine different, better futures, otherwise ways of living, being. And so I really hope that the festival does, you know, is work that transforms and transports us and really gives us a sense of possibility and potential by offering us something that's an experience that we haven't experienced before.
On that note, I want to look a little bit more at the audiences, and who do you imagine PUSH is for in terms of the audience? Who are you still trying to reach, and how do you invite audiences into more unfamiliar works?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a challenge. I mean, there's always so much more resource we could put into marketing and outreach. It's a truly diverse festival in terms of, as mentioned, the perspectives and practices on stage. But I think in this city, performing arts often get siloed, and you know, there are people who go to see dance shows, often dancers, and then there's people who don't, you know, just for an example. And a lot of the projects have content or thematics that can speak to a really broad audience, but if they don't already have a theater going practice, it's a real challenge. And so I think we kind of work at it slowly, you know, to the capacity we can. We do have an accessible PUSH program, which is focused on integrating access supports into the shows and working with artists to develop elements of the shows that can be developed so that they are more accessible to various people with different barriers to participation. And part of that role is the community ticketing. So specifically that focus is on partnering with organizations that serve and work with people who have financial barriers to participation. But also, this is Andrea Cowden, I just need to give her a shout out because she's so great. We do collaborate as well on, you know, for each project, okay, you know, is there a specific cultural community who, you know, would really, who this work is speaking to, that share a lived experience of the artist on stage that might connect with this work? And we do that to the extent that we can. I think this year we're talking about the festival as being a festival for the culturally fearless, and that's meant as less of a challenge and more as an invitation, hoping to cultivate a kind of practice of theater going where, you know, it's not just about I like it or I don't like it, but that there can be more of a like, okay, I didn't like this part of it. Why didn't I like this part of the show? But I did like this part of it. And why did I like this? Or why do, what are the other things affecting my experience of this work? Where do I think the artist is coming from? Did the artist achieve what they were trying to do? Like all those, you know, that ideally if the work sparks conversation, emotional response, that that there's some value in that. Because the thing is it is a very diverse festival and we have very diverse audiences. So that means that not every piece in the festival is for everybody that intersects with PUSH. So it's about how we try and communicate the work, and then also how we're trying to cultivate in our audiences a cultural fearlessness for different experiences. And we hope that people come to more than just one show in the festival so that they can get a bit of a breadth of experience and see how those, how the different pieces might be in conversation with each other.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of artists tend to thrive in the environment that PUSH curates?
Well, in terms of the artists that are part of the program, I would say a lot. But like, I wish that I could support more artists in being presented at PUSH, because, as mentioned, there's such a lack of presentation opportunities and opportunities to be have their work made visible beyond the city. But yeah, as mentioned, you know, there are a lot of artists. I'm going to start that over. So I spoke about adventurousness and form, and I think the festival prioritizes artists working interdisciplinarily, taking creative risks, working in unconventional ways, experimenting. So not a lot of conventional expressions of form. There are very few pieces in the festival where you can say, oh, that's dance or that's theater. Because of that porousness in expression. And I would say also that it's important that, you know, I try and think about cultural urgency. You know, we're living in a poly crisis. So for me, artists whose work is in relation to that reality, and it doesn't have to be in a literal way with, you know, a very with literal text about the experience of living now and in these times, though literal text can be part of it, but that their practice and that their lived experience and that, you know, they're creating from a place that is conscious of that reality with the wider world. So I think that's even something, you know, it might be a local artist, but the influences and the conversations they're part of and the way they're engaging, the research they're doing is engaged with a wider sense of the world.
And you've been with the festival for a couple years now. What surprised you the most about directing PUSH?
What has surprised me the most? That's a great question. I'm having a hard time coming up with the answer to that one. What surprised me the most? I think that sometimes I don't think I have an answer for that question right now. Sorry.
That's fine. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I just got one more before I let you go. What excites you the most about the festival's future?
Well, right now we're kind of taking it year by year. There will definitely be a PUSH next year. So I don't mean to, you know, alarm anyone, but there is a kind of living in the moment, experience because of the financial precarity. So it's hard to plan far in advance, just specifically with regards to arts funding. I will speak to, though, what I'm excited about in this festival. And I would say it's all the artists that are bringing us into diffracted and deep senses of time, that are giving us a sense of a more macro experience, that are weaving in ancestral and ancient embodied practices, and also opening up futurisms that exist outside of like the futures that dominant culture wants to provide for us. So I'm really excited that there are so many projects in this festival that really expand our sense of existence and help situate us in relation to possible futures. And there's so many projects that I'm just really excited to experience. There's so many, but, you know, ASCII-1 is one of these, catching up to the future of our past. Remember that time we met in the future, Split 2, Sepajiji. The list is pretty long.
Well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for meeting with me on such short notice.
Yeah, thank you for your interest in PUSH. Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hey, welcome back to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM. Burnaby, like you just heard that fun message say, thanks to Gabrielle Martin for joining us for that interview about the PUSH International Performing Arts Festival, which you still have this weekend to go check out all the various many things that are going on as part of PUSH Festival that runs until this Sunday, February 1st. You can go to pushfestival.ca for a schedule and tickets. Orpheus is still playing. Trouble Score. Oh, just kidding. It goes until February 8th, so you still have over a week. Next Sunday is the last bit, so go check out stuff. There's all sorts of cool things happening as part of the PUSH Festival, and you can expect more coverage of that and other arts things here on CJSF. Now we're going to hear about... which one are we going to do? We are going to listen to Danny's piece about salmon. So here we
from
go.
Burnaby, BC. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. A recently released study from the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences has identified a stark decrease in the monitoring of Pacific salmon populations over the past two decades. According to the study, this erosion in population data greatly decreases the ability of scientists to determine the status of close to half of Pacific salmon populations. To learn more about the implications of this monitoring decrease, as well as why it's been occurring, we spoke with Michael Price, adjunct professor of biological sciences at Simon Fraser University and co-author of this recent study. Please take a listen.
Well, this short abstract of it, without getting too much into the weeds, 2025, when we performed the research, it was the 20th anniversary of a groundbreaking policy of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Canada. They adopted what's known as the Wild Salmon Policy. So in 2005, this was initiated, and it was a new direction for salmon conservation. The conservation of salmon was seen as the highest priority above all other users, First Nations, recreation fishers, commercial fishing. It's conservation first and foremost. And then if there's an abundance of salmon, it goes down the line. So anyway, this was a transformative approach for Canada. And again, this being the 20th anniversary, it was trying to assess, well, how are salmon better off? How are we doing when it comes to adhering to the policy? And one of the primary pillars of the wild salmon policy is to assess the health of wild salmon populations. So we wanted to know, are we gathering the necessary information to assess the health of salmon populations? And that those fundamental data, or the fundamental information really, are the annual counts of salmon returning to spawning streams throughout British Columbia and the Yukon. So this is for Pacific salmon, Western Canada. And yeah, that was the nuts and bolts of it. Here we are 20 years later. Are we better off? Are we acquiring the necessary information? Have we improved over the last 20 years in terms of the amount of information we're gathering on salmon to assess their health? And in doing so, if we assess them as being at risk, then we can make informed decisions of how to turn the tide, how to improve the state for salmon. So that was the context for this work.
What were the, I guess, specific findings of the research in particular? I noticed that like one major thing that was brought up was this, what is being seen as a decline in monitoring regarding local salmon populations.
So over these last 20 years, yes, so we took it a step further. We looked at, you know, how many spawning populations do we have annual estimates for, annual counts of the number of fish returning to these populations. And then how does that translate into how many populations can we assess their health? And we used a specific index like each generation, say, of time, and how that's changed. So we can say that the amount of information we're gathering on salmon has declined by roughly a third over the last 20 years. It's been declining steeply since the mid-1980s. So we're now at essentially the lowest level ever. Since 1950, we're now counting the least number of spawning populations than we really ever have. And how that translates to how many populations can we today assess the health of? And the answer is roughly 50% or 55%. So we can only really tell the health of half of British Columbia and Yukon's populations. Those are the major findings. So for the other 50%, we have no idea, really, not necessarily for all of them, but for some of them, we don't even know if they continue to exist. We're no longer looking. That's the most worrying. The next level up from that is we don't know if those populations that we no longer have information for, are they declining? Are they at risk? And on the flip side of that is, might some of these be healthy, but because we don't know that they're healthy, there may be fishing opportunities that are no longer there out of an abundance of caution. So it kind of works two ways. In one way, if we don't have the information, we might be making fisheries decisions in the dark. We may be saying, yes, go ahead, go fishing out in the ocean, and we may be